Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of the TakeCast. My name is Davis Matic. You guys can find me on Twitter at Davis Matic. In this episode of the show, I'm joined by Ed Miller, one of the absolute sharpest guys that I follow on Twitter, a previous guest of the show. If you liked this show and you want to hear more, Ed was on one of the first episodes in January discussing his book, The Logic of Sports Betting. In this episode, we cover some coronavirus topics, online poker, kind of how online poker has changed during the quarantine period, and the future of sports betting and kind of how Ed and his sports betting company operated during the pandemic. Ed is, of course, one of the best guests we could have on the show. I think you guys will really enjoy it. If you want to support the show, you can leave a rating or review on iTunes. That is super helpful. And you can also subscribe to patreon.com/takecast for bonus episodes of the program. Now let's go ahead and get into it. All right, everyone, bringing in repeat guest Ed Miller. The last time he was on the show, we discussed his book, The Logic of Sports Betting, which, of course, you should go out and purchase. But since then, Ed, I have read two of your books, The Course and Poker's 1%, because like many people in my time in isolation, my time indoors, I've been playing a lot of online poker. Have you? First of all, actually, I wonder, have you been playing online poker during this?
No, I haven't.
Too
had
busy.
Time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you noticed though more people? I assume that you've sold some more books over this time frame as a result of people being locked indoors.
For sure, from all accounts, we're piling onto the poker sites. So.
Yeah.
It's not how I expected it to happen, but I'm not surprised. There's been a little bit of a of interest in it. Yeah.
Well, it's sort of interesting because as of right now, you are transitioning over from poker to sports betting. But as that transition has happened, it was a very interesting time for, I assume, many of us and many people who are listening to this podcast to work in sports as, all these things we are working on come to a complete halt, basically.
Yep.
So, you were one of the first people on Twitter to start talking about COVID-19 in China as it arose and being like, look, this is not going to be good. This is not going to be bad. So in terms of what you expected the coronavirus's impact in the United States to look like versus what actually happened, what kind of the hypothetical versus the reality, what were the differences from your perspective?
Yeah, for sure. So, back in, let's say, January or early February, I mean, what was clear was, like, this was the worst disease that had happened in a while. I read a lot of history, and there's been a lot of, like, terrible plagues in history, so, like, this is not top 10 on that list, but clear that this was kind of the worst one that had come around a long time. And I was like, well, that's to me, like, as far as I knew kind of worldwide it was going to cause a major impact. And what was in my head was, like, I wasn't sure how the U.S. was going to respond. Wasn't sure, if it would respond with a coordinated, okay, here's the military. We're going to set aside places for people to quarantine. We're going to, food distribution. We're going to have, I wasn't sure, how organized it would be, or as it turned out, very disorganized, unfortunately. And so that was the big question mark in my mind, was how the U.S. was going to respond to it. It hasn't been great, in my opinion, unfortunately.
Yeah, hasn't been great. So in terms of, interpreting the data, right, we are starting to see a lot of smaller countries, isolated countries, so for example, very low death rates in Japan, in New Zealand, they're back to live sporting events with fans there. So this sort of this thing that was thrown out with the United States was that, we have all this space, right? We have just this massive land area and people live, outside of Los Angeles, New York, San Francisco, people live more spread out. So a lot of people were very hopeful that living more spread out was going to be beneficial to the spread of the virus. And I actually kind of think in the end that mindset worked against us because it took so much longer for precautions to be implemented in the United States. I think that that feeling of, you know, we are uniquely positioned to do better to face a global pandemic actually really backfired.
I mean, it's hard to argue with that at this point. I mean, you know, I think we did have a lot of natural advantages, but like, if you just, you know, I mean, time is the big most important thing. And if you just squander, you know, several months, which is, in my opinion, kind of what happened, I mean, all the advantages don't really matter, you know. So that's kind of my interpretation of what happened. You know, if we'd have sprung into action as a country in January, in February, you know, and gotten organized and gotten the messaging, you know, said, okay, this is the plan. This is what we're going to do. All right, folks, you got to do A, B, and C. We're going to get through this. And, you know, we're going to, I mean, I think it would have been a much different outcome, but, you know.
Yeah, there were a lot of different paths to take, and, you know, the leadership, both at a state and a federal level, you know, kind of across the United States. I think the mixed messaging obviously doesn't help, you know, when your governor right. is telling you one thing and your mayor is telling you a different thing, or, you know, your favorite Twitter accounts are telling you one thing and then you're hearing another. Like, I think sort of what happened is there was that 6 week period from like March 13th, 14th to about the end of April where, you know, I think that even the coronavirus is a hoax people or whatever were staying inside. They were wearing masks or whatever. And then it sort of just, I don't know, like, I guess people just got tired of being in their houses or thought that the virus had been defeated.
You can't ask people to put their lives on hold indefinitely for,
yeah.
you know, potentially, you know, 18. I mean, it's just, you know, it got to a point where it's like, okay, well, what now? I mean, to me, that period was great because it's like, okay, well, you kind of screwed up February, but like, all right, you got 6 weeks here, you know, to put a real plan in place and to get messaging in place and say, okay, folks, this is the plan now. And that, I mean, that just didn't happen. And I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, that's where I'm at on it now is it's like, well, people are like, lock it all up again. And I'm like, so that we, so for what? I mean, then what?
Yeah, that, you know, that mean, can't be the solution.
We already did it once, right? And, you know, you got 6 weeks to get a plan in place and there was, you know, essentially, and I mean, you know, repeating that isn't going to fix anything. So I mean, I don't know. I do not claim to have solutions to any of this at this point. I mean, it's, you know, kind of a mess as far as how the U.S. has responded. And I mean, my perspective about what is likely to happen is we're basically going to just muddle through it until there's a vaccine or until it kind of burns out. And I mean, that's not a good outcome. And I'm saying that that's likely to be the outcome, but I mean, I'm being honest about what I see, you know? So, yeah.
If we want to speak in gambling terms, it's like we're hoping to go runner of like herd immunity, vaccine earlier than we hope, or that the virus mutates into a less deadly form because, you know, for a virus to survive, it can't kill all of its hosts, basically.
I think there's another option, which is therapeutics. There's a lot of drugs actually that are fairly promising that aren't getting headlines. I think thankfully not getting headlines because the hydroxychloroquine got a few many headlines. You know, there's some other drugs that are looked at to repurpose that seem to have real positive effects on certainly the severe cases. So, hopefully kind of those trials go through, you know, the efficacy is confirmed, you know, supplies are secured and, you know, maybe some people who get sick end up, you know, getting drugs and, you know, have a better course. That's I think really likely to happen. And that's a good thing. So.
Yeah. And, I mean, also one of the things that I have very consistently read is that, at all of these hospitals where they have had success, so like there were a couple hospitals in Chicago that had success, a couple in California, they had this vitamin cocktail that they were giving patients. It was a multivitamin, zinc, magnesium, echinacea, and a vitamin I had never heard of before called quercetin, which was apparently very helpful in dealing with the cytokine storm. Now, you know, someone gunned to my head right now is going to try and get me to define cytokine storm, and I won't be able to, but I mean, this was actual reports confirmed at multiple hospitals. So I've been taking that vitamin cocktail every day with lunch. Okay. and a full glass of water. Cause like, obviously I'm obviously deadly terrified of getting COVID. Like no one wants to get it, but also right. It just felt like the easiest preventative in the world. It's like, if this works in these hospitals and theoretically boosts your immune system to this virus, like why wouldn't you?
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And you know, I mean, I think the biggest danger, like, you know, I mean, I'm in Las Vegas and, you know, it's kind of burning hot here at the moment, unfortunately. And, you know, I'm starting to see reports of, you know, the hospitals are getting a little bit overburdened, not crazy, but, you know, I mean, I definitely feel for the people that are putting in the shifts every day, because I don't think they're getting a day off for a long time. And, you know, I mean, situation, it's not great. I think it's going to be a short-term thing, and then eventually calm down and, you know, we're going to get care. And, I mean, we're going to get to the other side of it. It just, you know, didn't have to be this much associated with it, but. Yeah,
it didn't have to be this bad, right? There were paths where it didn't have to be this bad, but you know, we're here, whatever. We're all dealing with the consequences as a result of that. I to go back to poker real quick, have you been tempted at all to play the World Series online? This is, to me, of all the weird dystopian things as a result of the world moving online, the idea of there have been bracelets won online in the past, but the idea of an entire summer of World Series bracelet events being taken place on all these different sites too, by the way, you know, not just one site or anything like it. This is one of the weirdest, like, had you told me this in 2010, I would not have believed it style stories.
Right. Yeah. It's funny because online poker has never held the allure for me that live poker did. Like I was a live poker player. That's how I kind of fell in love with the game. And I actually had trouble kind of forcing myself to play online, you know, and even in that period when it was like super lucrative, and I knew it. And I was like, man, if I just sit in this chair and click these buttons, like print money, and I did it some, but like, I mean, I just, you know, especially I was in my 20s and I was like, I just hated that, you know, it was just boring to me. I mean, you know, playing any more than 2 hours at a time was just like, I mean, I was just like done after 2 hours. And so, yeah, I mean, online tournaments are like, I'm not sure I've ever played an online tournament. Like I've played sit and goes, but I don't think I've ever played an online multi-table tournament because exactly that phenomenon. It's like, goes on for a long time.
I mean, you know? let me tell you, as someone who has played a fair amount, it is not a very rewarding experience. Because again, you know, the structure of a lot of these events, now it's better for the World Series, obviously, but the structure of very many online multi-table tournaments is you sit there for 7 hours, you click, 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 and you make like 1.75x your entry, and you feel like you just wasted 7 hours sitting in front of a computer. Like, at least with live poker, there's that experience of like you're in the card room, you know, you're chatting with your table mates, you feel like there's just more stimulation for your brain, basically. But you know, and especially like, you know, you're sitting there on your computer for that long playing, like you're probably watching YouTube videos, you're probably checking Twitter, like there's no way you're playing like your optimal level game and keeping good notes and everything. Like it is one of those things where there are probably a lot of poker pros who welcome this, right? Who are very good online players. They don't like people that much. That's a kind of a common thread between a lot of very good poker players.
Right.
But like, you know, every summer I would watch some World Series events. I have not, you know, I've not tuned in to any of these streams or anything like that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's cool. I think that it's cool that the poker's chugging along and, you know, kind of making it work again during this period. And, you know, and I do think it's cool there's a resurgence of online poker. I think online poker is good. I think it should be legal in more states. I think it should be a thing. People like to play poker, you know. You know, it's just, it's funny because, I mean, being so closely associated with poker, you know, everyone's like, oh, you play the tournament. I mean, I just don't, you know, I always played cash games. I always liked the the in and out of cash games where I can start when I want. I could
leave whenever.
I mean, to me, that was the whole point of playing poker for a living, right? I mean, I started doing it when I was 22. I quit my job. I moved to Vegas. You know, I mean, the allure was I do it when I want. I don't when I'm done. I'm, you know, and I really enjoyed that part of it. And to me, tournaments always, you know, were the opposite of that. They were like, I'm actually stuck in this chair until 2 o'clock in the morning, whether I like it kind of thing. And yeah, I don't know.
Oh, this is a good question then along those lines. What are your thoughts on Zoom poker, which is the, you know, fast fold, right? Which is like all these guys, you know, Ben Solsky and all of the run at once pros, like all the really good online crushers now play. Well, I guess not the guys who are playing like super mega high stakes because there's not enough players in the pool, but like a lot of the very good mid stakes pros now play Zoom poker, and I've played it a little bit. I've transitioned to it more now instead of playing full ring online. And my thought is that it is exploitable, obviously, for very good players. You know, it's still profitable, but like it does feel a little bit more soulless than playing regular poker for
sure. It's more technical. It's more like the. I think there's fewer ways to be good at it, right? Like in live poker, there's people that succeed who are fundamentally not, like, they play too many hands, they, you know, make systematic mistakes, they don't really understand the game, the math of the game that well. But they always succeeded and did well because they had soft skills. They had teleskills, they had, honestly, the ability to recruit people to games, you know, get people to play with them. All that stuff. I mean, I've been successful for years, or at this point, decades, you know, with these kind of softer poker skills. And Zoom is like the opposite of that, right? Like, Zoom is like, take all of those, throw them out the window, and you know, who's got the math of the game down better? And that's legitimate. I think that's 100% legitimate, but it's, you know, that's, it's going to appeal to somebody with those skills. And, you know, not, I mean, the thing is, you're not going to get, we're not going to play the Zoom with you who don't have those skills, right? Almost, because they're just going to get crushed. They're also not going to have fun. You know, the thing about poker is everybody who plays poker regularly is kind of good at something, pretty much. And if the form of poker, like, completely, like, it's just obvious that what you're good at is not really a part of this particular form of poker, they're just not going to play it, right? So that's my take on Zoom. I mean, I think it's completely the right idea for guys like that to play Zoom. I mean, they get more hands in, it emphasizes what they're good at, you know, makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's literally a math equation of like, how can I play the most possible hands? How can I play them in the most GTO way without like, you know, some sites have HUDs, some sites don't have HUDs. That's a relatively big argument inside of the poker community right now. Like,
right.
both like the ethics and morality of some players having HUDs, some players not having them. But yeah, it's just a game of like, how can I get as many hands and play to my frequencies that I've generated in Pio Solver, you know, through hours and hours of studying, and how can I play as true to those frequencies as possible, which is, as someone who stopped following poker entirely after Black Friday, pretty much picked it up again and got back into it during quarantine, like that whole experience of finding out what frequencies are, right? So like reading Andrew Brogus's book, Thinking Poker, and or Play Optimal Poker and Play Optimal Poker 2, and like learning about solvers, like it, like if you would have engaged in poker content in 2010 or I guess 2011 is when it all went away. It was about, you know, what is best for me to do here. And now it's, what can I do here 70% of the time, 20% of the time, and 10% of the time. And it is, it's very much a shock to the system, which is a big chunk of what Poker's 1% is about. But it's also, I mean, it's very helpful, like life stuff too. It's just to think of terms and think of things and ranges of outcomes. And also, you know, very helpful for sports too. And I'm surprised that it kind of took so long to bleed into poker, but the frequency stuff is very fascinating as someone who was away for so long.
Right. No, that makes sense. Yeah. I think it's a cool way to think about, as you say, like a little bit, like You know, like, what are you? I definitely mean, how people could have, you know, apply that same concept to stuff in life, and you know, what do I want? What do I want to present my counterparty with? You know, I don't want to be too predictable. You know, that whole concept is interesting.
So during the pandemic, we had about a 3-month period well, 2-month period with no team sports at all, right? Anywhere in the world, right? Belarusian soccer was about like the highest level that we got into. Yeah. So for those people who don't know, you've moved on to a service that basically computes live odds correct, right? And so one of the main outcomes from the logic of sports betting is kind of the final frontier for profitable sports betting right now, other than, you know, betting lines, you know, wait, like immediately when they come out during the price discovery phase, is betting in game, right? Live betting for football and basketball and women's tennis and everything. So I'm wondering, what was your experience like in terms of working with your models and everything during that off period? Like, did you feel like that was a time to get caught up? Did you feel like that was, you know, a lost time where you needed the live sports to work? Like, what was that experience like for you and Matthew?
So the big thing we did was, you know, I mean, obviously in March we were ready to get our MLB product, you know, kind of put the finishing touch. Just to be clear, our business is, our primary business is we are selling odds feeds to sportsbook operators.
So yeah.
We're, our goal is to help sportsbook operators offer a better product for their customers, especially the live product. I mean, we do pregame odds too, and props
right.
and stuff, but the reason why an operator would pick us as opposed to the competitors is that our live product is the best. So, March, obviously we were like, you know, we'd never offered our MLB product to a customer before. You know, we had live customers who wanted the MLB, you know, so we were all gearing up to get that going. And then basically it became clear they weren't going to play baseball for several months. So we kind of ramped it. We said, well, why work on something that's not going to be deployed for a few months? So, we kind of just put that in the freezer, and actually, NBA was not on our roadmap until the next NBA season. Just how we cut something, and that's what we cut. So we went back to NBA. We said, we think they're going to play NBA. We thought they were going to play NBA before they played baseball. You know, that was the idea. Apparently.
Yeah. Turns out
that was wrong. So that's really what I spent most of the time on. I was grinding on that, our NBA product. And so kind of, you know, we had kind of the sketch of a model for that from before, but really, you know, built a full-fledged NBA model, you know, built it into our system so that, you know, we have the models, and then we have a whole system where we can basically compute our live lines, you know, on a moment's notice with new information, you know, and publish them to customers. So it's a whole pipeline of, you know, the information comes in, goes through the flows through the model, and then goes out to customers. And so we had to kind of get that whole pipeline working, not just for NBA. And the other thing, we got it working sort of for all sports. We have, even there's sports we don't have models for, but we still want to be able to make and publish live lines for those sports too. So like MMA, we worked on that, you know, so we were publishing some MMA live lines. I don't know how good they were because we're just kind of doing the best we can on those as opposed to the ones we have models for. But yeah, that's how we spent the time is kind of pivoting towards stuff that we had put on the back burner and said, hey, why don't we get this hammered out? So
did you find yourself interested in any of the esports, League of Legends, CSGO? Because that was for the daily fantasy operators for DraftKings and FanDuel. There was kind of like a month period there where like that was it. That was all they could offer. Like there was nothing else that existed for them.
So we briefly looked at some of these sports sims that they were
yeah,
where they were running the Madden or whatever they were. Yeah, that was interesting. I don't know. We looked at that briefly, and then we stopped looking at it, I would say. It's interesting because I actually think potentially that's a thing that could be popular long term. I think it needs a little more refinement than, you know, what they rolled out with, you know, on a, you know, second's notice basically. But I think that concept is interesting. I think that might have legs. I could see like having a better Sims product, a more polished Sims product with a, you know, with a DFS type game built around it, you know, as like, you know, okay, it's the morning of baseball, you know, and you can set your lineups for the evening, but you can also kind of toss in two lineups into this Sims, you know, they might sim the whole slate, right? Or something, you know, I don't know. I could see something cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think
League of
we
Legends, I League of Legends is still a little bridge too far for me. I got into it.
Well. It's like a decent sweat. I mean, one of the things I learned about myself is that I like sports, but I think I like gambling a little bit more than I like sports. So like League of Legends, Madden Sims, NBA 2K Sims, like all of those things were it was fair game. And I think probably sportsbook operators and daily fantasy operators learn that as well. They like I would imagine that there are contingencies being put in place to allow the action to continue to flow if there was ever another stoppage like this, because you know, I would imagine that that the operator data saw is that if there were things being offered, they were still generating traffic and yep. revenue, and it didn't particularly matter what the said thing was. But the last thing I want to tackle here is long term for the growth of sports betting, for sports betting legalization in the United States. I actually think there is some small positive outcomes here for sports betting in the United States, which is some of the states that would have been on the fence for mobile betting, I think they saw the absolute need. For example, in Illinois, you know, the plan was to put sports betting legalization for mobile on hold for 18 months. And they were like, we need the revenue. Like, we got it. We just got to get this mobile legislation passed now. So I'm kind of wondering what your thoughts are on the immediate, next 5-10 years impact of this stuff on sports betting in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, it's hard to argue with that. I think you're probably right. You know, I think, I mean, the thing is, and this is what I've always thought about sports betting. I mean, I always thought it was weird that sports betting was kind of illegal because it's such an American thing. And, like, nobody actually, like, in America thinks it, I mean, people do, but, like it's, like, most Americans are completely comfortable with sports betting. So I expect it to be kind of passed in some form in most states within five to 10 years. You know, there's some states have political, you know, complexities, I would say, because they have, I mean, the states with big tribal, California is like the big one where they've got a bunch of tribes, and they have California, and they have, you know, where there's, they really have to hammer out, okay, who gets how much money where is that's the big impediment, I think, to a lot of these states, is just figuring out exactly who gets what money. But, you know, in principle, I feel like, you know, sports in particular is going to be, you know, go throughout most of the country and online. I think they're going to figure out that it needs to be online. It's an online product. There's absolutely no reason to require it to be live and in person. It's not a better product. It's a different product, and it's, in many ways, it's worse if you require people to, you know, come to the counter. Certainly live betting is like day if it's online versus, you know, over the counter. So I expect that to happen. You know, I kind of expected poker to kind of tag along.
Same.
In a lot
yeah.
of these bills.
Very weird.
It doesn't seem to be. I'm a little surprised by that. And then it's interesting because the online casino is tagging along in more. It almost seems like in more of these states than the online poker. And like that would be the one that would kind of trip the wire the most. I mean, I certainly, people have concerns about, you know, online casino, and I get those concerns. And so I don't know. It's interesting. I'm curious to see. On the other hand, online casino generates a ton of revenue too. So I, you know, it's just
yeah. I mean, you're making more money. Yeah, you're making more money offering online blackjack and craps than you are offering online, like, 1-2 games. Like, it's just, it's the nature, like, the dirty little secret about poker is that it's the worst for brick-and-mortar casinos and online casinos. Like, the amount of handle that it generates is just going to be lower than everything else you can offer, though, you know, you don't
have the ecosystem thing where you've got to manage the good players and the, you know, it's just tricky. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things I had hoped, was that online poker would tag along, you know, as we have sports betting legislation proposed where I live, seems like it's probably going to become a thing, and it's just it's a bummer to know that I have to play, like, on global poker and these sites that are, like, doing these hilarious things to skirt the legal legislations. But it's, poker being illegal was part of the UIGEA to begin with, which is what is being repealed for all these states to start passing sports betting legalization. So I guess probably the issue is that the lobbying body for sports betting is 100 times bigger than the lobbying body for online poker. Like, the online poker lobbying body is very, very small.
Right. I mean, the leagues kind of switched their position for the most part on sports betting from being against it to now being for it. That's huge. And, you know, if the leagues are saying yes, please do this, you know, there's nobody like that for poker, right? You know, there's no trillion dollar
league.
Right, exactly.
So. Yeah, there's no Roger Goodell to be poking them in the ribs saying, look, we need to get this done, because it's undeniably good for the NFL, the NBA, the NHL, and everything to have more ways for fans to engage with the games, right?
I always thought it was nuts that they were against it for so long. I was like, why are you against this? This is clearly in your interest. I mean, I'm sure they could probably explain it to me, and I'm sure they had good reasons, but you know, it never made a ton of sense to me. So,
well, yeah, it's that fake American puritanical belief, right? Because, like,
it might be, I don't know, yeah, maybe.
That's my theory, because in England, you know, like, it's like casinos, like, own teams, right? Like, you go to an English Premier League game and you have Bet365, you know, advertising literally on jerseys, or, like, Macau casino owners are owning teams and buying teams and everything.
So,
and
I don't know if you know, the UK is actually in meltdown about that right now.
Because of Wigan Athletic. They're, if for those of you who want a good read this afternoon, Google Wigan Athletic English Championship and go read the story of what's going on there. They are in total meltdown about it right now.
Yeah. So
very interesting.
They ask, you know, it's funny, because, and they say, well, I think the U.S. is 5 years behind on the meltdown, and I'm like, I don't know. I think some people from the U.K. kind of think that, you know, their model is like, oh, well, the U.S. is just the U.K. except 5 years behind, and I'm like, I don't think so. I mean, we're very different countries and cultures and legal and everything, so I don't know. But, yeah, interesting. It's kind of a popcorn thing for me.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Ed, thank you very much for the time. Tell people, tell them where to buy the books. Which book would you most want people to go buy right now?
I mean, the Logic of Sports Betting is our sports betting book. I think it's honestly, if you are interested in doing any sports betting, I highly recommend reading that book. It kind of covers all the basics about how the industry works, how lines get made. And then if you want to, learn to kind of find edges, kind of exactly the logic, you know, it's not a handicapping book. It's about kind of the logic of how to find edges in the sports betting market. So I would definitely say The Logic of Sports Betting. Ed Miller and my author, Matt Davidow, and you can get it at Amazon. That's kind of where you get it.
Yep. And if you want to hear more about that book, you can go back and listen to the first episode of January of this show, and you can hear Ed and Matthew talk a little bit more about that book specifically. I would encourage you to go and do that. Go buy the book. If you're playing cards, I would definitely go read The Course by Ed. And if you really like that one and you want to get better, I would read Poker's 1%. There we go. Everyone, thanks for listening to the show. We'll be back soon.